people don't understand how gutted the manufacturing base in the United States is.
Having to compete on the world stage with two hands tied behind their back. Not just one, but two.
Europe is heading for a catastrophe. I mean, a serious economic catastrophe.
So much huge change going on all at once in technology, in government, in society, in culture. Everything's changing all at once. Everything.
You know, Kathy's worldview is very clear. We know what her worldview is. Innovation drives growth that will fix so much of society's ill. What I was excited about was the breadth and depth of the analysis. So it's not like throwing off a standard formula, you know, just tossing it off as so many public figures do today. They use the sort of the shibboleth of the day and they toss it off. She's done the work. And so when you talk about it, she, you know, every point she will underscore with the detail and the proof. And so it shines out of the whole conversation. Every topic we touched, she just, you know, immediately into the depth of it and into the breadth of it.
Yeah.
So it's, you don't often meet those people. And when you do, it's a very special time and conversation.
Yeah. I think, like, for me, what I didn't really understand about her approach, and again, like her background, like I knew about Kathy, I knew about ARK, I knew about how much they have high conviction on game-changing technologies. But yeah, the thing that completely went over my head was, like, she's been doing this for a really, really, really long time. And, yeah, and she was responsible for calling some gigantic macro trends in the back in the day accurately, completely against the grain.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. And under really dire circumstances, because it took, as it always does, it took longer than you'd imagine for these very, you know, the various reasons. Well, the principal reason was that, you know, the money supply was being crunched in order to get inflation down. This is the Volcker, you know, period. And so the impact of what Reagan was doing was set back. And so her analysis, while very accurate in outcome, was somewhat delayed in timing.
Right.
And so she had to support her thesis against all odds, even in this period where things weren't going her way. And I raise that because we're in that kind of moment right now.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. There's a direct, it's almost like today's time is analogous to the time she went through before. So it's like, I understand why she has a conviction she does, because a lot of the underlying factors are basically the same.
Yes.
You know? Yeah.
And Larry, can you explain just briefly for the audience exactly what her call was, when it was, and this kind of air gap between her prediction and then seeing the results of the prediction, just in case people aren't really understanding from the interview with Kathy what the context is here.
So she's a student of Art Laffer. Art Laffer is, I describe him as the economist most deserving of a Nobel Prize that has never won a Nobel Prize. Art Laffer is the progenitor of the Laffer curve, and the Laffer curve is a curve that shows that as tax rates come down, so collections go, for classic reasons, you know, that the less people have to hide or duck taxes, the lower the rate is, the happier they are to pay it.
People don't feel ripped off.
Not only that, but the growth is also increased quite significantly. That, you know, that is built into the whole school of economics that Art Laffer represents. And it's, you know, there are many other famous economists who have also, you know, riffed on that and built out the theory. But when she was in an investment company, Jennison was the name of the company, as an economist after she'd been I think only about 5 or so years, she tells the story in the industry, and she was hired as the economist, and you know, and she had a hand in also picking investments, I believe, at that point. But she was criticized by, you know, the high mucky mucks of the industry, and they would come in there and they'd have these conferences and they'd critique her, and she'd have to defend herself against some of the great names in the industry at the time, in the investment world at that time. But she was certain that the Reagan tax cuts would result in a huge increase in revenue, and that ultimately it would balance the budget. They were living through a moment that we're living through right now, which was all a result of the Nixon-Carter era. I mean, Nixon took us off the gold standard, something Art Laffer fought against very strong. It led to, you know, this collapse and led to huge increases in money supply to try and offset that. Reminds me of today. And ultimately what had happened is that they just caused enormous inflation. And so the whole context of the Reagan administration was, on the one hand, to drop income tax rates back to reasonable levels, to free up industry, to reduce bureaucratic hold over the economy. Everything's familiar to our current state. But at the same time, they had this gigantic inflation bubble. I mean, we think inflation was bad in the last couple of years. Yeah. Inflation was getting out of hand. It was climbing towards the 15-20% mark. So,
and remind people what interest rates were in that time and what Volcker did.
Interest rates were so high that the man in the street, the common business person couldn't borrow money. I mean, interest rates were tending towards the 15-20% mark as considered normal. It was just crazy. It was crazy. I mean, so ultimately what happened was that towards the end of the Reagan era and into the Bush era, you know, things started normalizing. Bush made a huge mistake of allowing taxes to rise, even though he had promised, you know, read my lips, no. And we're talking about the first Bush, read my lips, no more taxes or whatever. And he broke his promise.
And then he got kicked out of the White House.
That led to, you know, the election of, you know, the famous reversal and Clinton's huge election win. And that led to, you know, that period where actually Clinton implemented the Reagan policies. And that was largely because the House was controlled by the Republicans. And so there was this partnership for the first time, not the first time, as a novelty in modern times, where, you know, the president and the speaker really, and the opposite, and the Speaker of the House from the opposite party really worked together. And we had the so-called Contract for America. And anyway, the point is, everything she said came to pass. And the company she worked for, Jennison, you know, had a 20-year run of huge success. So we're living through that sort of moment again. You know, it kind of went the full circle. We had these tax and spend governments, you know, through the incredibly, you know, we had this terrible.
Literally everyone since Clinton.
No, not really. George W. Bush really tried to reform not only the tax code, but also, more importantly, the whole Social Security system. And he was trounced in doing that. He was, you know, the Republicans as much as the Democrats. That would have made a huge difference. I don't think he was a spend, but the problem is he went to war. He went to
war. And war is spending.
And war is spend. But it's really the crisis that occurred, the 2008 crisis that occurred was like a open sesame. Famously, you know, Obama came in with this gigantic, at the time, a gigantic bill for almost $1 trillion. At that time, $1 trillion was a lot of money. And that led to, you know, 8 years of tax and spend, tax and spend, tax and spend. And then, you know, we had the first 2.5 years or 3 years of Trump, where there was a clawback of taxes, there was somewhat of a revision of expenditure, but not much because so much was on automatic pilot. Then came COVID. And Trump, out of necessity, poured a huge amount of cash. Crisis, needed the cash, just like wartime. And we were coming out of it, and, you know, comes Biden. And out of the blue, Biden decides to spend two gigantic dollops of money. One is the COVID part two. When COVID was over, the money had been spent already. The money, you know, the economy was in a state of recovery. And he just put so much fuel on the fire. Boom, just caught a light. And then the Federal Reserve had to cut back. And then, it, as if it wasn't enough, he sprung the IRA on us. Little did we know that that was really just an excuse to give a lot of non-governmental, you know, his friends and family a huge, huge, huge dollop of money through these so-called NGOs. We didn't know it at the time. We now know it, but that's what was happening. The problem is he had to spend that much money in order to give that much money away. Well, he wanted to give that much money away. So, you know, $1 trillion, what's another $1 trillion? Let's make it $1.5 trillion to make it good. And that just blew the top off. Now, to close that down and cure the problem, we have to go through, you know, what Volcker took us through. And in this case, you know, it's a huge tragedy. There is a, I posted this morning, I posted a link to it. There is a all-in, not a conference, but an all-in
conversation with Bessent.
Scott Bessent.
I got to watch that.
You got to watch that, because everything we heard from Kathy just makes so much sense when you listen to Scott Bessent talking about how he's going to go about solving it, and what the, you know, how we missed the opportunity, what the problems were, and now what the solution is. And it ain't easy. It's not going to be. But what Scott doesn't talk about, you know, Scott talks about the fix from an economic point of view, and that takes me back to Art Laffer. It's a true Laffer fix. It's a true, you know, it's a true, you know, classical, you know,
faith in markets, that if you reduce the hurdle of what it takes to for economic activity to happen, for people to do business, that you can grow your way out of giant holes.
Well, that and the reduction in tax rates, which will increase revenue. And then the whole question. So there's another whole question which I introduced into the conversation, and that is this question of, you know, these famous tariffs that Trump is so focused on. And there's receiving a lot of criticism, and because it strikes at the heart of what the monetarists believe in, which is, you know, you should have open trade, that tariffs are a tax and tariffs lead to inflation. And that's the classical approach. So, you know, you want everybody to do the thing they're best at doing, and that way prices fall across the trade and everybody does well. But the problem is, and this is what I raised in the conversation, the problem is that we have a set of tariffs right now which make no sense at all. The United States is heavily biased. There's a heavy bias against the United States in the tariff structure of the world. And it's far worse than I even said in the conversation with, because I had a conversation, some notes with Michael Dunn, who's talked about this at length and who's investigated this at great length. And it's not just the tariffs; it's all the rules and laws that each country used to raise barriers that aren't even tariff bound. So they tax, and then they also block certain, like China has these rules and laws against imports, which is not tariff bound, but it's just, you know, you're not allowed to import this stuff from the United States. And Europe has the same. And so it's part tariffs and part regulations and part laws that they've used to raise these huge walls throughout the world against the United States. And yeah. The point is that the conversation with Kathy really drilled into the money supply issue and the tariff issues, but there are so many more that abound. But her focus is on what innovation is going to do in terms of productivity and the potential to drive up productivity. Now, if you combine what Scott says with what Kathy says, you have really, the best of both worlds, by far the best. But like happened at the time of Volcker, there's always the third, there's always the, unforeseen that can lengthen the time that the cure takes. I mean, it's like any serious disease, there's always factors that may be hidden or that may be complications that you don't allow for.
Yeah. And I think the one thing that gets, I would say, missed in the tariff discussion as well, which I don't see talked about enough, and something that, like you talked about, now that you're doing all your road trips to the United States, you see it with your own two eyes, the desolation in a lot of the parts of the country that used to be hubs of manufacturing. People don't understand how gutted the manufacturing base in the United States is. They do not understand.
And that doesn't affect the people just who are employed.
It's their entire community.
And that was my point that I made to Kathy about how serious the problem really is. I mean, we talk about, innovation, and we talk about the excitement, we talk about all of this, and we all invest in it, and we all benefit from it. But when you get on the road and you drive through these small towns and you stop in these small towns, yeah, there's nice hotels and there's, there are the McDonald's and all the glitz at the stop. But I always drive into the towns, and honestly, they have been gutted. I mean, beyond gutted. Some of the towns are like just desolate. And I see these gigantic textile factories with moss growing over them, huge, huge plants. Some of, it's hard to describe just how big some of these plants are. And they're just overgrown. And even the for sale signs have been rotted and overgrown. And you see people playing in kids playing in the streets. They're in poverty, serious poverty.
And it's just so infuriating when you think about the messaging. Oh, all those plants closed down because of how lazy Americans are, and they want too much for their money and all those things. When, the reality that you brought up is at least as big of a factor, if not more of a factor, that when all the other countries in the world put tariffs on our goods when we send them overseas, but we don't put tariffs on their goods when they send them here, then that American worker would have to be twice as productive as a worker in another part of the country or in another part of the world in order to compete on fair footing. So that's the thing that I think people don't understand, is that American manufacturing and American labor has been having to compete on the world stage with two hands tied behind their back, not just one, but two.
And their legs, because the labor from the countries that we're competing against, that labor per hour is a fraction of the one in the United States. It's a double whammy.
Some of it is slave labor.
100%. Yeah, and I think... So here's the very exciting thing about the ARC thesis, though, right? Which is, and this is something that we've covered on the channel multiple times, which is, I think, is starting to gain steam in the broader discourse, I hope, is with the advent of innovation and the advent of artificial intelligence and robotics, with the challenges that come with it, this is America's only chance to be competitive on the world stage when it comes to trade. Because as you bring down the cost of labor, as you bring down the cost of generating something in the country, right? Of making something, let's say using human or robots or artificial intelligence, that's the only way that I can think of outside of going into a let's say tariff war to try and get the tariffs to be actually competitive. The holy grail is just offering the labor through automation that's going to be much, much cheaper than the labor that Mexico could do or that China could do. And then all that manufacturer reshores back into the United States. And then the United States taxpayer wins by doing that because now we have the means of production, right? It's like, it's similar to the, if you think about the Middle East situation with countries like the UAE and Saudi and all these places, one of the reasons why they don't offer any tax, why they don't have any taxes in those countries is because they make so much money from exporting their natural resources. The United States could do the same exact thing when it comes to artificial intelligence, robotics, and labor. Like that's one thing that I don't see talked about enough, is that can be our holy grail. That's the true innovation here, is that we just become the world's makers of everything. America can do that.
So let me, yes, and...
pour cold water on it?
No. I want to say yes. Everything you said is absolutely on target. And let me remind you that Tesla manufactures its cars with close on 80% US-made content in the United States of America. And those cars are competitive with cars that we import or that we manufacture here from imported parts. Now, let me tell you, Mercedes-Benz and BMW, two European manufacturers that have huge barriers against the import of cars from the United States. So to show the United States that they, you know, that they reciprocate, they put their plants here in the United States. But let me tell you something. They've been here for 20 years, but they still import almost 100% of the components of those cars.
Yeah, they do the bare minimum that they have to in order to get access to our market.
That is exactly right. The amount of labor that they move here to the United States is minimal. But if you look at Tesla, and this is the point that I want to add to your point, Fawzat, I don't underestimate the value and the opportunity of fully roboticized manufacturers. But I will tell you, it's more than 5 years away. It may be as much as 10 or 15 years
for sure.
Away. That's a long time to wait in what we have to do to the economy. Today, Tesla is employing, you know, something like 80,000 people across the United States and are manufacturing with something like 45,000 or 50,000 people. I don't know if these numbers are exact. They're sort of in the ballpark.
And should be over 100,000, you know, when you then factor in their supply base here in the U.S.
Yeah, if you include the supply base, it's huge.
Well over 100,000.
Not to say that they're not importing some parts from Mexico and some parts from China, not to exclude that. But they're making their batteries here, or they're having their batteries made here by their suppliers, and that's a huge component. Huge percentage of the car, well, we know it's over 80% of the car is actually manufactured in the United States. And so what I'm saying is that there is absolutely no reason at all that we cannot, with today's technology, not tomorrow's technology, not the technology of a decade hence, not the technology we're still trying to create, but today's technology, there is no reason not to manufacture in the United States, except one. And I'm not going to use the word tariff because it's a, you know, it sets people off. Trade barriers, global trade barriers erected against the United States of America. Now, does the United States have trade barriers against the rest of the world? We do have some, but nothing compared to the reciprocal barriers. You know, we all know that China just simply, you know, there's a law against importing most of the stuff that we export and the services we export. But apart from that, I mean, the trade barriers in country after country in the whole of the EU are such that we cannot manufacture anything and send it to them. So it's both tariffs and it's trade barriers. And what Trump is doing is exactly the right thing to do at this moment that will turn the tide even before the automation that you talk about. So the automation you talk about and what Kathy talks about in terms of innovation, which is another way of saying automation, but the AI and all the technologies she talks about, all of that
productivity growth.
The productivity growth. All of that is important and critical to our future. But today, to get out of the trouble that we're in today, could be done automatically by tearing down those trade barriers. And that is what Trump is about.
Do you think how realistic, you know, I've been thinking about this. And again, like this is why that Kathy interview is so fascinating, because of exactly this conversation. Like, I feel like every 5 to 10 minutes in that conversation, you could have 2 hours worth of podcasts just on that 5 to 10 minutes. You know,
we could have gone off on any of those subjects. It was very hard to keep the conversation, you know, flowing and moving along. Yes. It was very, very hard.
It's almost like we should ask Kathy if she'd be up for doing like a quarterly Maverick Mind with you. And then we can use that as an excuse to go down to St. Pete.
Good, because, you know, there's so much depth there. And I have these brains. I'm at Brainstorm every week with her, and it's just, there is so much that they cover. It's amazing. But you know what, Kathy, you know, she has this breadth of view. She doesn't get herself mired into any of these pillars and yet she seems to have this
instinct,
understanding of each of these, you know, technologies that is quite amazing, you know. So it's an extraordinary mind. It is a maverick mind.
She really is. Okay, so how realistic is it that we're going to exit this? Like, what is the chance of having true pain in the next 4 years, given what Trump's trying to do from a tariff perspective? Because if I think about it, right, if like what is the force and function going to do? It's likely going to slow down the economy, which we're already seeing. Just look at the inflation numbers. If I bring up Trueflation, which the way I view the inflation numbers is, if the economy is slowing, that's going to create a forcing function downwards towards demand, which is going to increase supply, which is going to lower prices. So in a weird way, tariffs are doing this whole negotiation that Trump is going down the path of with tariffs. It's kind of creating this uncertainty in the market, it seems like, that people are like, should I buy? Should I not buy? Should I bring product here? Should I not bring product here? What does the economy look like? Why are you doing this? It's kind of creating disruption, which is lowering demand. But it might get us to a point where with enough economic slowdown and the inflation coming down significantly, let's say into potential deflation territory, this is going to incentivize the Fed to lower rates, which is going to create economic stimulus, because it's going to be easier to borrow money to potentially bring production back to the United States, because now you're creating a forcing function for that production to come back, right? Or the flip side is, oh, this economic uncertainty is going to create a flywheel of a downward turn, where you're going to have businesses having to slow down, which is going to cause them to lay people off. You know, that whole sort of recession, depression flywheel that you can get into. So what, if you were to put on your crystal ball hat, Larry, so you're putting on your crystal ball hat, okay? What do you think is the likeliest outcome in the next, say, 2 to 4 years from what's going on now?
I've been calling for a recession for the last couple of years, which means that if I keep going, I'll be right sometime.
And I think we have been. And I think we have been in a recession, if think about it. Yeah.
Yeah. I was going to make the point that I've been right all along. The problem is the recession exists in the lower two-thirds of the economy, while the upper third of the economy has been enjoying
the S&P 300.
No, the S&P 7, the Magnificent 7. I mean, if you look at the results, you know, you can actually draw a line. If you look at the results of companies, you can draw a line at companies that are hugely successful and those that are, you know, just kind of traipsing along. But if you look at the people earning under $100,000 a year, they are living hand to mouth, and many of them are not living hand to mouth. They are behind. They've got into debt. They're, you know, families are broken up. There's a huge drug problem. So the lower two thirds have been suffering a serious recession, and you can pick those trades that are really in serious recession. You know, whether you're the building trades or you can actually pick out which parts of the economy are in recession, which ones are doing well, and clearly tech is doing well, banking is doing well, and financial services are doing well, and tech is doing well. But other than that, people are suffering. And so I think
you forgot the one that has been doing the most well, that was now going into not doing well. All those non-governmental organizations, they were having a nice heyday.
Yeah, yeah, they were doing extraordinary. They have been doing extraordinarily well, and the probability is that they will continue doing quite well even under this administration. But yeah, if you look at credit balances on, I mean, its consumer credit is pretty high right now. Yeah. Even though interest rates are not nearly where they were in the 80s, where, you know, the problems were, the inflation had got so out of hand. But, you know, you should listen to the Scott Bessent interview on, you know, today. It was just remarkable how they covered almost the entire panoply of problems and how to address them and how he thinks of addressing them. And I think they have the right formula, but the question is, have they enough time? I don't think this government has enough time. 4 years is not enough time. And the question is, will they be able to continue? Will they keep control of the Congress at the midterms? These are political problems that, you know, we can't solve.
Quick question to go back to the credit, like the interest rate point, Larry. In the 80s, were there credit cards that had these rates that are like so much higher? You know, I mean, you talk about under Volcker, interest rates of 15 to 20%, or then the credit cards, 30, 40%?
Or no, the credit card, the differential between the interest rate on the credit card and banking and normal banking credit has crept up consistently over the decades. It was probably from memory, and I'm an old man, I don't have much of a memory anymore. Can't remember names at all. So, but my memory, if memory serves, there was maybe a 3% difference. It grew to a 5% difference and just blew out to like 10% difference.
I mean, that makes me wonder about, you know, making a comparison between interest rates today and interest rates in the 80s. Yeah, if you just look at the Fed rate, that's one thing. But then if you look at the fact that a lot of this consumer credit is on credit cards, that even before interest rates crept up or 15%, now maybe they're between 20 and 30%, then maybe it really does look a lot more similar in terms of the types of interest, you know, amounts that people are paying out of their budget.
Hans, that's a brilliant observation. I think you're exactly right. And in a way, if you listen to the Bessent interview, he tackled that by saying that the problem is the banks have been so regulated that they no longer are the prime source of money. He calls for a significant deregulation, particularly, and he focused several times in that conversation on community banks, getting them back to doing the business of banking and replacing credit card debt. Credit card debt is one of the most damaging features. You've picked it exactly right. One of the most damaging features of our modern economy.
Yeah. And what's crazy is if you really think about the state of banking today, all the regulations that were put forth in post the financial crisis in 2008, right? Those regulations led way to the banking situation which we have now, which is we have four major banks and every other bank is going kaput.
Well, it's actually five or six, but you're right. You're absolutely
a handful of banks.
Yeah. You're absolutely correct. There are the four giants, but there are a few smaller ones that enjoy or are privileged in the same way.
Too big to fail.
Too big to fail. And you know, Scott really focused on that today. I mean, he said it probably four times. But Hans's point is the key point, that in the end, there has to be credit. And so once you close the banks down, literally close them down, which is what they've done, you know, a huge percentage of the banks closed after 2008. Huge percentage. Some went out of business, but some, you know, just merged and then closed the smaller branches and so on and so forth. But credit will arise. Credit is necessary for a modern economy. And so where does it come? Comes in the credit cards. And what is the rate? 15%, 20%, 30%. Just unbelievable. We would not have conceived of those rates back in the day. And so that, yeah.
Go ahead.
No, I was just confirming.
Yeah. No, for sure, for sure. And I think what's the conversation I'm seeing now from government officials, and I think AOC and a Republican are trying to pass a bill to cap the interest rates on credit cards at 10%. But I think all that's going to do is that's going to move government to fund those banks to subsidize the credit cards. So now we're turning
I mean, you try and control costs, and you get to 2000, you get back to, you know, the 1980s, 1970s very quickly. It's, you can't.
People who think they're too smart messing with markets and ultimately just blowing things.
I mean, that's what's going to happen. So, you know, AOC lives in the socialist world that is this perfect nirvana where everybody loves each other and the government loves you and the government does everything for you. And what can go wrong? You know, what can go wrong?
Nothing,
well,
Larry.
We've never had a socialist solution that's worked yet. And, you know, I mean, it's incredible. It's just incredible. I mean, you need a country with almost, you know, perfect. It just can't happen. I mean, the closest we've ever got to was were the Nordics, and they were not socialist at all. People said they were socialist, but they weren't, and they certainly aren't.
But even in the context of this conversation, Larry, it does cause me to re-examine that narrative that we've heard for so long. You know, like, what if we were more like Sweden? What if we were more like Norway? You know, they have socialized education and socialized healthcare, and it all works, and it's this beautiful utopia. And then when you contextualize that in the conversation of trade imbalances and trade barriers, that there's probably a good argument to be made that all of those social services that they were able to provide their citizens were literally born on the backs of these trade imbalances with the United States, so that the United States labor market almost paid for a lot of the social welfare benefits that many countries in Europe have enjoyed for the last several decades.
Or can I give you one other one too? And this one is going to be very controversial. Or the fact that the United States through NATO has shouldered the burden of defense
all
of that
defense.
Entire region, right? Basically all the defense in a lot of different ways, which is creating a lot of security in that region, which is allowing those regions to have those kind of policies. But if the United States was like, you know what? I'm going to stop defending you guys. You all are on your own. Good luck allocating those funds to the social programs.
Well, I think all the above is true, but I think that if you point to the Nordics themselves, I think that the reason for the success of a more socialist economy, not a socialist economy, but a more socialist economy, is the homogenous nature of the population. That has broken down completely, and so times there are completely different now. As to the rest of Europe is a dying continent. From an economic standpoint, they are in serious, serious jeopardy. I mean, if you think we're in a bad way, and if you think we were in a bad way in the 1970s, Europe is heading for a catastrophe. I mean, a serious economic catastrophe. You know, productivity is on a strong down curve, the economy, the growth of the economy is on a strong down curve, and they're dying. They're dying from these crazy policies that are being imposed upon Europe, you know, unilaterally from this out of control, you know, executive committee of the EU and this out of control woman who runs Europe like a dictator. I'm very concerned for Europe in general. And, you know, Holland, which is a country, I once had a company, my company was based out of Holland, was headquartered out of Holland. So I know a little bit about the country. I mean, what's happened in Holland is just, in the Netherlands, I shouldn't, but what's happened in the Netherlands is disastrous. And so I wouldn't point to them and say, oh, they have this great system. No, it was a great system as long as, you know, they were still able to milk the economy and milk the economy and roll up and incur debt. But they're in a point now that I don't know that how they're going to recover. And the biggest problem is this crazy climate business they've got. You know, I'm all for preserving the climate, but not at the cost of the economy, because that will destroy the climate anyway.
Yeah, I think the challenging discussion there is, I think when you, it's like it almost requires a societal philosophical change to dig oneself out of that hole. Because what does that mean is that when you realize that the safety nets or the things that you've built around your region that create a certain quality of life and a certain floor and a certain, like, let's say, ceiling, let's say, like a state of life that is acceptable to most, right? When that entire thing is breaking down, the only thing you can do to get yourself out of that hole is to work really, really, really hard and go through a lot of discomfort and pain to rebuild the thing that you're trying to build. But that requires abandoning the old way of life and getting back into building stuff. And I love Europe. I was born in Spain. I lived there for 12 years. You know, I understand some of the Western European culture pretty well, I would say. And I just, with the bureaucracy and I think the overall philosophy, especially as compared to a country like the United States, I wonder what it's going to take for the society to realize the kind of situation that they're in. You know, I don't know. And I might be talking very ignorantly about this, and I'm sure some people from Europe will tell me that I don't know what I'm talking about. But I mean,
and other ones will tell you that you know exactly what you're talking about. I mean, I think it is very polarized in Europe right now. The commentary that I see specifically on this issue.
Yeah. So I don't know. I think it's. I agree with you. I think it's. Well,
in Europe, you would probably be labeled far right. You would probably.
It's far Zod. Larry, not far right. You know, I saw that comment many times on X. What are you, far right? I'm like, no. No.
By the way, I was witness to the fact that a lady in the coffee shop wrote your name correctly on the cup. So,
what do you think about that?
Yeah, I was witness to that. It wasn't a Starbucks, by the way.
That's why. Yeah.
People with blue hair don't know how to spell.
I'm very concerned for Europe, and so one aspect is the financial. The other aspect is the issue of immigration. I mean, it is pretty serious stuff. It is pretty serious stuff where they are with immigration. It's, you know, I think they've done serious damage to themselves, and I don't know how they get out of it. I guess there'll be another war in Europe.
Yeah, I think to me, it's like it comes down to, and again, controversial topic, but, you know, Overton window has opened so widely that why should we not talk about this? You know, you think about Europe and you think about the United States. The United States had a giant influx of illegal immigrants in the last 3-4 years. And it definitely impacted the country in negative ways. And I'm not saying those illegal immigrants are inherently bad people. I think a vast majority of them are good people just looking for a better life. And the United States set up a great people. But the United States set up a perverse incentive for these people to come. But with that incentive also came a very small minority that is causing chaos, which in a weird way, it has made it really bad for immigrants in the United States, period.
Yeah, terrible. Right? Look, two thirds of the people on this call are immigrants.
Yeah.
We're very supportive of immigrants, I assume.
Yeah, Hans, in your face.
I mean, I don't know where Hans stands on this or sits on this, but, you know, I mean, immigration, the United States has proven, is a really good thing.
Yes. Excellent thing. The best thing.
Sorry, go ahead, Hans.
I would say I agree that it is a really good thing for us culturally over the long, like America is a nation of immigrants, you know, built by immigrants for immigrants, but it's always a chaotic and messy process also. But at least for the history of the United States, like that is the entire identity of our nation. We've always had this messy, chaotic process for hundreds of years. That, you know, there was never a time when there was a stable set of people who were not then having to culturally integrate with a new wave of immigrants.
We're
and
all
the fact of the matter is that that is not the culture and the situation in Europe at all. They do not have a cultural history that is resilient enough to deal with these ginormous cultural shocks that come with giant waves of immigrants who have completely different cultural norms, social values, all of these things. And so, you know, I think America has a much better tolerance for this type of disruption in cultural disruption than Europe does. And then B, like, it's just a lot bigger country. Like,
that's it.
You know, the United States is freaking huge. And so when big. You yeah, talk Europe, about
Europe is also pretty damn big.
It is, but they don't have the, I mean, with in each individual country.
Damn big.
Yeah, but if you 100%, but if you really think about just the function of, like, is it going to be easier for America to absorb a million immigrants, or is it going to be easier for Europe to absorb a million immigrants? And if you just think
maybe
about
Europe is one thing, but yeah, if you look at Germany as a country, or France as a country, or the United Kingdom, or Norway, or Sweden, or all these other places, like, they don't have the same type of identity as Europeans that Americans have as Americans, even though we're broken into these states.
Yeah, I think your point is well made. I think the real difference is not so much the size of the country, but the unique culture of each of the countries within Europe.
Yeah.
And the disruption to that culture. Look, I talked about knowing, you know, the Netherlands very well. I was in the Netherlands just in summer. I'll be going back again this summer. I mean, Amsterdam is minority Dutch, and many, many cities in the Netherlands are now minority Dutch. They're majority Muslim, And I can tell you the culture has been disrupted. I mean, when you get Jew baiting in the streets and you get, you know, Jews being beaten in the streets, that's a different culture. So you only have to visit downtown Stockholm to know that there are no-go areas in Stockholm.
Yeah, I think, you know, and this is, and I think, you know, the disruption is when you allow too much, the minority groups become, like, the minority extreme parts of that culture that comes in become a disruption, even though, like, a lot of people want to be, let's say, just live a peaceful life and all that stuff. But when you have too many people come in, by default, the extreme disruptor just gets bigger, and there's only a critical mass you have to hit that's going to create societal disruption for the entire country, which again puts a huge damper and a ceiling on the acceptance of immigration altogether, because it's completely uncontrolled and just willy-nilly, come on in, you know, let's hang out, and then you have a disruption to the fabric of any country's society, especially a place that, again, like in Europe.
There's an additional factor too, just like the force. There needs to be an expectation and a cultural forcing function that, okay, if you're going to come here, you are going to integrate into the society. Like, Larry, you're from South Africa, from a Jewish heritage. Farzad, you're, you know, from Spain, or, you know, from Iran via Spain, and you have a Muslim heritage. But here in the United States, there is an expectation that when you come here, that regardless of all of those things, that you're going to become an American. And part of the problem with this, you know, recent wave of immigration into Europe is that there's been this cultural backlash against the countries that they're coming to, that they should not force these immigrants to then become whatever social identity that those countries had to begin with. So, you know, Muslims coming into the UK, they're not expected to become British. Or into Germany, they're not expected to become German. Or coming into France, expected to be French. It's just like you have to let us come here and then be from wherever we are.
That's partially true. But, you know, I mean, you look at the Turkish immigration into Germany in post-war years in the 70s and the 80s. It was extremely peaceful. There were some tensions, but in the end they were resolved. And, you know, most Turkish Germans view themselves today in second generation, third generation, as Germans. And they're very proud Germans. That isn't true of today's immigration.
And that's my point, is that this progressive ideology that is facilitating this wave of immigration, at the same time as it's saying, let's bring in more people, it's also saying that it's actually bad to ask people to integrate into the society.
Right. That's true. It's a social norm that is very, very disruptive. Very disruptive indeed. Anyway, we kind of strayed a little bit from, you know, Kathy's interview. And we're kind of building our own little world of anger and distrust and negative.
Well, I do think in a almost like a weird way, I do think the fundamental disruptions that are happening in society is really like the macro, like there's so much huge change going on all at once. Yeah. So much huge change going on all at once in technology, in government, in society, in culture. Everything's changing all at once. Everything, right? And I think that's the overarching theme here. And like, and Kathy's work with ARC is one extremely important subset, but it's still such a small subset of all the change that's going. Like if we were talking about Kathy in 2010 or 2011, she'd be like the one of two giant things happening. Today, she's like one of 100 things happening, you know? And that's what makes this time so fascinating. So,
it is exciting times. Technology is exploding. Builders are building in the United States. And I'm hoping we get back to manufacturing. I think this president, for all his faults, and there are plenty, and everybody knows them very well, he's doing a huge service. Politicians have been on sort of autopilot, building their NGOs for their retirement and, you know, for their friends and family, and sort of following the sort of expected institutional path that these two institutional parties are forcing them down. And it's been, it's been bad. And so we need another disruption. So we had a Kennedy, we had a Reagan, we had a Clinton, have to give it to Clinton. You can add whichever Republican name you want to that, but we had a Clinton. And now we have, a Trump. And and an Elon, at our cost. Guys, we're shareholders in Tesla, and Tesla's under siege right now.
Well, for Trump's 1,000 different faults and the things that he, could do a lot better on, at least he's not celebrating when Tesla stock goes down like Tim Walz.
Right. I think one can criticize Trump all day long, and there's a lot to criticize, but I've learned that there's a lot more to Trump than Trump.
Yeah, I agree.
He's so quite a remarkable person.
Maybe this is, one of the questions that I've had in the back of my mind as we've been having this whole discussion is, given the crystal ball predictions that you've made about the pain ahead and the lack of time that this administration has to really see the fruit of all of this stuff that they're doing. It's very important, very necessary for the future of America, for the future of the American economy, that we're kind of going to be digesting some short-term pain for those long-term gains and benefits.
Right.
How do you see the impact of that on Elon and his companies in this season of the now but not yet that Kathy kind of went through with her predictions in the 80s and 90s.
For me to predict anything about Elon, I've learned painfully that it's just not a good... there's no value in it because, A, I'm going to be wrong, and B, I'm going to attract a whole lot of...
You don't want to be that guy again? You like being this guy?
Elon is such a remarkable mind. You cannot think ahead for him. A lot of people do in our community and say, we're going to do this, and they're going to do that, and they're going to do that. I've given up. He's far, far, his mind is far, far too rich and far too far-seeing for me to actually figure out how he navigates this. I have a lot of confidence he will navigate it. I have a lot of confidence he'll navigate his companies through it. I'm very optimistic for the future of Musk.
And I guess maybe I should have worded my question a little bit differently, more towards the public perception of him and his companies. Do you have a prediction there that you're, or what's your feeling about how everything is going to be perceived at the macro level?
Yeah, honestly think that the public's behind him. If I were to guess, I would say he has a 65% positive ratio. Maybe I'm exaggerating. Maybe it's as low as 60%. I don't think it's below 60%.
Depending on the poll, I mean, I've seen his popularity at 45% approve, 55% disapprove. It depends on what you're looking at.
I don't believe in polls at all. My confidence in polls is at zero.
I was able to call the election better than any pollster out there. And I'm an idiot.
Except Rasmussen. Rasmussen got
it. Fair enough.
And I'd be interested in a Rasmussen poll, but I'd still have zero confidence in it. In other words, it'll be informative, but I'm not going to place any money bets on it. And the other thing is polls are a very specific moment in time.
And a specific type of person that answers a poll as well.
And times are very dynamic. Very, very dynamic. Very dynamic. Listen, Scott Bessent said it today. He said, you know, he always thought that the Congressional Budget Office numbers were absolutely spot on and they knew what they were doing. And now that he's in there and he sees what they do, he realizes they have no frigging clue. None. And I think it's the same with pollsters.
I agree. I think one of my biggest realizations in life, and this is a huge learning lesson for, I think, maybe people that are listening to this that are let's say, in their 20s, early 30s, trying to figure out how to sort of navigate life. The best assumption you can make is that nobody knows what the hell they're doing. Nobody knows what the hell
they're
doing.
It's idiots all the way up.
It's idiots all the way up and all the way down. Everybody's trying their best to make the best possible decision, but there are very, 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 very few people in this world that have a good grasp on what they're doing. Okay. And these are in the less than 5%, less than 1%. Just assume everybody's trying their best and assume that nobody knows what they're doing. And if you go in with that mentality, I'm telling you, you're going to realize that holy shit, society is being held by duct tape, but it works. And that's why there's forward momentum because there's constant improvement. There's constant improvement.
Sometimes the duct tape breaks. I've lived through some times where tape didn't hold. Anyway, back to the Kathy interview. I have to say it was an honor of a lifetime sitting with her and just talking. She has a depth of understanding not only of innovation and technology, but also of economics. And so it's just such a privilege to have been able to do that.
Kind. And I think the other thing too about like after meeting her in person, you know, super kind, super warm. I visited Ireland a couple times. She has Irish heritage. I mean, she reminds me of that warmth that I received from the Irish people in Ireland.
It's true.
And if Kathy, you're watching this, man, Ireland is the best, the most underrated country to visit, in my opinion. Truly, I really, really like that.
Great food. I mean, some of the greatest restaurants are in Dublin. No doubt.
You gotta give me that list because I didn't find those last time I went.
I can give you that. I have it.
Yeah, I would love it. Awesome. Okay, anything else we want to talk about before we wrap the sucker up and we send people to the Kathy interview in case they haven't seen it?
I've talked too much already.
That's never the case, Larry. You have too much wisdom. You know too much, Larry. Hans?
Yeah, I would echo that. Larry, it's always great to talk to you, pick your brain, hear your perspective, because there's a lot of wisdom in there. And it helps us to understand at that next level deeper what we're seeing.
Yeah. Little known fact about Larry, which I'll share, the dude knows his wine. St. Pete, boy.
That's one thing I will admit to. I owe many, many, many pounds of overweight my love of wine.
That second night, we were downtown. We went to...
these secrets.
Okay, all right. Go watch the Kathy interview. We'll have a link. Bye-bye.
Bye.